Welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real courtroom drama. I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and we're going to jump right into the swing of things today. A lot of what we're going to talk about today revolves around the concept of self-defense. What is self-defense? What specific actions are protected? And when does a person's own behavior preclude them from asserting self-defense? If a person is the author or orchestrator of a dangerous situation, and then uses force in response to that situation, can they still claim self-defense? We're also going to discuss judicial oversight, what remedies are available to each party when a judge makes a manifestly unfair ruling. What does an unfair ruling really look like? Typically, on this show, we discuss one particular case. We dig into the background a bit, go through the rulings, the narratives, the evidence, and the strategies to get a sense of who is more persuasive and why. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. Today we're going to cover two cases, and I think it'll go smoothly because they work really well as tools for comparison. Both cases deal with defendants asserting self-defense, but the fact patterns leading up to the incidents are wildly different. So I think this will give us a real understanding of just how self-defense works, when it's available, and how to effectively argue it as a lawyer. Our two cases today are Wisconsin v. Rittenhouse, as well as the trial over the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery, and that's Georgia v. Gregory and Travis McMichael and William Roddy Bryan. It's been a long time since I gave my standard disclaimer on this show, but this episode requires it. This is not a social justice podcast. I don't take a position in the culture war and defend it. This is a legal podcast where we break down legal arguments and rulings. We discuss lawyer strategy and its efficacy. If you're looking for an echo chamber on your own personal views on Kyle Rittenhouse or any of the Georgia defendants, then this may not be the podcast for you. There are countless programs which will label Rittenhouse a white supremacist or a true patriot, and will make up all sorts of fact patterns to justify their positions. I'm not going to discuss his personal views and feelings, except to the extent that they become relevant to his trial. The same goes for the McMichael and Bryan trial down in Georgia. For the sake of simplicity, I'm just going to refer to the trial as the Travis McMichael trial, because he's the one who actually shot Ahmaud Arbery. So when you hear me talk about McMichael, it will typically apply to all three defendants, unless I make it clear otherwise. But this is not going to be a show dedicated to showing that McMichael is a racist, a white supremacist, or a closet supporter of the Ku Klux Klan. That's simply not how true legal analysis is conducted. That's what celebrities, actors, late-night talk show hosts, and op-ed writers do. And it's fine for what it is, but if you're looking to actually understand these cases, it's a waste. If you want an honest, unbiased analysis of how these trials were conducted, then tune in. But I'm going to ask you to do exactly what the juries in these cases were instructed to do. Leave your biases at the door. Come in with an open mind and listen to what the evidence in the case actually showed. Turn down your personal feelings and disregard anything you've read in the media or on Twitter. It's largely simply inaccurate. If you can do that, if you're willing to say, okay, tell me straight, what did these juries consider? And how did they come to the verdicts that they did? Then I think you'll get a lot out of this episode. If your posture, however, is how did the jury get one case so wrong and the other case so right, then you probably aren't going to enjoy the episode, because you're looking for confirmation from me that there was a right and a wrong answer, and that the jury was wrong in one case. And that's simply not what I do. So if you're still here, and you're willing to critically examine the evidence and the rulings, I think you'll see that these cases were not all that surprising in how the juries came back. Unless you've been living under a rock for the last 18 months, you're familiar with the fact patterns of these two cases, but here they are in a nutshell once again. Kyle Rittenhouse. Rittenhouse was a 17-year-old who lived with his mother in Illinois. His father lived in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where Rittenhouse stayed frequently, where he had a job and some friends. After the police shooting of Jacob Blake, the streets of Kenosha were filled with both protesters for police reform as well as counter-protesters. Rittenhouse goes from Illinois to Wisconsin. He meets up with a group, which could charitably be called a local militia, and the group posts up at a car lot to defend property rights. Basically, they view their role as to make sure the place doesn't get torched to the ground during the unrest. At least that's what they claim. On August 25th, 2020, the streets of Kenosha are chaotic. Lots of buildings are set on fire. For the most part, there's very little by way of person-to-person violence, but significant property damage was done. Now, Rittenhouse was with this group. He's armed with an AR-15 assault rifle. This is a semi-automatic rifle which chambers a new round with each trigger pull. So you pull the trigger, then pull it again, and pull it again, and it will keep firing shots. Rittenhouse did not bring the gun with him from Illinois. He got it from a friend in Wisconsin when he arrived. While at first, Rittenhouse and his militia were simply on the car lot roof watching the protesters walk down the street, eventually Rittenhouse comes down to street level. He gets separated from the group and finds himself alone. At this point, Rittenhouse encounters the first person who he would end up shooting to death that night, Joseph Rosenbaum. Rosenbaum was a 36-year-old man who had been released that morning from a Milwaukee hospital for psychiatric issues. Rosenbaum, carrying a chain, made advances toward Rittenhouse, who turned and fled. Rosenbaum gave chase and encouraged other protesters to do the same. Within a few moments, Rosenbaum is caught up to Rittenhouse, who had then shot him. He would die shortly thereafter. Rittenhouse flees again. He was running down the middle of the street. A crowd, who witnessed the first shooting, is giving chase. And the second individual who Rittenhouse shoots, a man named Anthony Huber, enters. Huber was carrying a skateboard, which he used to hit Rittenhouse in the back of the head, knocking him off balance. Moments later, Rittenhouse shoots him. A few seconds after that, a man named Gage Grosskreutz, the third person shot by Rittenhouse, loses 90% of his right bicep as Rittenhouse turned the AR-15 on him. Rittenhouse then runs toward law enforcement, who at first turn him away, but he eventually surrenders without further incident. Now let's discuss McMichael. Travis McMichael is Gregory McMichael's son. Roddy Bryan is their neighbor. They live in the Satilla Shores community in Glynn County, Georgia. Ahmaud Arbery was shot to death on February 23rd, 2020. He was running through the neighborhood when McMichael and the co-defendants decided to intercept him. The father and son were in the same pickup truck, and Bryan was in his own car behind. Bryan had a cell phone out and was recording. McMichael eventually found Arbery running and caught up to him. Armed with a shotgun, he stopped Arbery. Bryan's camera does not fully show the encounter, but here's what it does show. The truck, driven by Travis McMichael, had pulled up in front of Arbery and stopped. Bryan was behind Arbery the whole time, kind of boxing him in. Gregory McMichael was clearly armed with a .357 and standing in the bed of the truck, while Travis exited the truck with his shotgun. Arbery tried to run around the truck, and then there are multiple gunshots. Three shotgun blasts. The first is obscured by the truck itself, but then Travis and Arbery reemerge. They move off the screen again and reemerge again. At that time, both of them have hands on the gun, which is fired again into Ahmaud Arbery, which ultimately kills him. The three men remain on scene until law enforcement arrived. Now, both Rittenhouse and McMichael asserted a self-defense claim. Now, you have to understand what must be established in order to prevail, arguing self-defense. So let's look at Wisconsin first. Here is what the statute in Wisconsin says. A person is privileged to threaten or intentionally use force against another for the purpose of preventing or terminating what the person reasonably believes to be an unlawful interference with his or her person by such other person. The actor may intentionally use only such force or threat thereof as the actor reasonably believes is necessary to prevent or terminate the interference. The actor may not intentionally use force which is intended or likely to cause death or great bodily harm unless the actor reasonably believes that such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great harm to himself or herself. Now, the statute goes on to discuss provocation. In essence, the law is that one cannot provoke a response from another person, then rely on that response to use force and then claim self-defense, with the exception that the actor reasonably believes that they are in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm. Then, under Wisconsin law, you can use deadly force even if you were the provoker, as long as you have exhausted every reasonable means of escape prior to using force. So that's self-defense in Wisconsin. Let's take a look at Georgia. It's similar, but there is a noticeable exception. Here's the statute. A person is justified in threatening or using force against another when, and to the extent that he or she may reasonably believe that such threat or force is necessary to defend himself or herself or a third person against such other's imminent use of unlawful force. A person is justified in using force which is intended or likely to cause death or great bodily harm only if he or she reasonably believes that such force is necessary to prevent death or great bodily injury to himself or herself or to a third party. Georgia has its own version of the provocation provision. It says that a person who initially provokes the use of force against himself with the intent to use such force as an excuse to inflict harm on the other, cannot claim self-defense. So Georgia's a little stricter. We'll first look at the Rittenhouse case. Let's talk parties. Rittenhouse was represented by Mark Richards and Corey Chirafisi, both seasoned veterans in criminal defense. As we're all well aware, this case made immediate national headlines. Before any of us could blink, there were hundreds of editorials, completely bereft of any factual support, either propping Rittenhouse up as a Second Amendment icon or as a white supremacist who was in Kenosha looking to just shoot any protester he could. Now, fundraising campaigns were instituted on Rittenhouse's behalf, and his legal bills were paid by others, which is how he was able to afford very expensive, very high profile, and very, very talented lawyers. The prosecutor on the case was Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger. He was a 7-year veteran of the Kenosha District Attorney's Office, and prior to that, he had worked as a prosecutor in Milwaukee. The case was overseen by the Honorable Bruce Schroeder. He is the longest-serving state court judge in the entire state of Wisconsin. He's been serving as a state court judge since 1983. He attended Marquette University for both undergraduate and law school, serving as a police officer while in college. He was hired as an assistant district attorney after he passed the bar in 1970. Less than 2 years later, the district attorney at the time was appointed to a vacant judgeship, and the Democratic Party backed Schroeder to be the replacement DA, and he was indeed appointed. Following year, he ran on the Democratic ticket and defeated the Republican challenger to remain the DA. He then engaged in private practice from 1974 to 1983 when he was appointed to the bench. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about the prosecution, Thomas Binger's narrative in the Rittenhouse trial. What was it that Thomas Binger wanted the jury to believe? It was no secret that Rittenhouse was claiming self-defense. This was not a whodunit case. There was no question Rittenhouse had shot three people and that two of them had died. The only question was whether there was self-defense. Thomas Binger knows the self-defense standard in Wisconsin, so he knew what narrative would be necessary to disprove it. Binger portrayed Rittenhouse as a cavalier, trigger-happy wannabe cop. He wanted the jury to determine that Rittenhouse was the provocateur to the entire series of events, the aggressor and the cause, and therefore he could not claim self-defense. Binger started out by putting on witnesses who had taken video of the scene. There were a number of individuals on the streets of Kenosha that night recording the protests on their cell phones. There's an incredibly chilling video of Rosenbaum shortly after he was shot, and the jury could literally hear the life draining out of him. It was a very powerful start to Binger's case. Binger also had drone video where he had isolated Rittenhouse and Rosenbaum and played pieces of it to show their relative locations at certain times. There were many, many cell phone recordings of the streets that night. And I get why Binger started this way. I think it was very, very effective. I watched the close-up video of people huddled over Rosenbaum as he lay dying, and I was horrified. It was emotionally jarring, to say the least. There were additional videos of Rittenhouse fleeing the crowd, getting tracked down, and getting hit by Anthony Huber with a skateboard, and then the struggle for his rifle. Then the shots fired into Huber, and then Grosskreutz moments later. These were necessary to give the jury a real sense of what happened that night, and Rittenhouse's role in the mayhem. But Binger made what I think are several massive mistakes at this point. One essential part of being a prosecutor, especially doing trial work, is knowing how many witnesses are enough and how many becomes too much. If you're putting on witnesses to simply affirm what other witnesses have already said, you're opening the door for inconsistencies. So Binger put on too many witnesses, but he also compounded that error with an even more egregious problem. He failed to adequately prepare his witnesses or know what they were going to say on the stand. An honest and ethical attorney will never tell a witness what to say on the stand, but they will know what their witnesses are going to say because they've gone over their testimony several times prior to putting them on the stand. The last thing you want from a witness that you are directing is an answer that you're not ready for. Also, you need to prepare your witnesses for cross-examination. They need to be made aware of what types of questions they may get, and the attorney needs to know how they'll answer so that the attorney can either address certain points preemptively, or you can at least know the weak points of your testimony so you can shore them up in other aspects of the case. So here's what happened with Binger's witnesses. Binger was portraying Rittenhouse as someone looking for the opportunity to shoot protesters. He opened on it. It was a central theme of his entire case. But he kept putting on witnesses who had recorded video of Rittenhouse from that night that completely contradicted this narrative. One prosecution witness testified that when he met Rittenhouse that night, he was offering water to protesters. There were video clips of Rittenhouse saying he was just there to make sure nobody got hurt. There's absolutely no reason to put this witness on if you're the prosecutor. He advanced nothing in the prosecution's case, but he significantly damaged Binger's credibility with the jury. Perhaps the greatest show of failing to prep a witness or the ability to know what a witness was going to say was during the testimony of the surviving shooting victim, Gage Grosskreutz. Grosskreutz had been attending various BLM protests, had some training as a medic, so he carried a first aid kit around and would generally help out anyone who was injured in some way. And, you know, this action made him very likable to the jury. But on cross-examination, it came out that Grosskreutz was standing right next to Huber, and Huber tried to rip the rifle away from Rittenhouse. And then after Rittenhouse shot Huber, he briefly had the gun trained on Grosskreutz. But Grosskreutz's testimony was that Rittenhouse did not shoot him until he drew his own firearm, Grosskreutz had a pistol with him, and pointed it at Rittenhouse. It was only then that Rittenhouse fired the shot into his right arm. Now that testimony was a massive blow to the prosecution's case. Having watched the trial, the prosecution witnesses really did not paint Rittenhouse in the way that Binger described him in his opening. Rittenhouse's lawyers, Richards and Chirifisi, deserve a lot of credit for really capitalizing on every error Binger made. With each prosecution witness, they really emphasized the fact that cell phone video journalists all had interactions with Rittenhouse, which were pleasant and benign. Rittenhouse never came across as the aggressive deviant that Binger claimed that he was. It was also the prosecution witnesses who testified that they heard Rosenbaum threaten Rittenhouse while chasing him wielding a chain. Again, it was unnecessary for Binger to put these people on. They did not advance his narrative, and the defense team capitalized on each one. I've seen a lot of articles and more tweets than I can even count, which accused Judge Schroeder of tipping the scales in favor of Rittenhouse. There is some merit to this. The pretrial ruling whereby Binger was told he would not be allowed to refer to Rosenbaum, Huber, or Grosskreutz as victims, but that the defense could refer to them as looters and rioters, was manifestly unfair. I think it clearly showcased that the judge was sympathetic to Rittenhouse, no question. But this case was not won or lost because of the judge. In fact, nearly every prosecution witness did use the term victim at some point, and Judge Schroeder never did anything about it. What really gets me is that people were criticizing the judge for yelling at the prosecutor during the cross-examination of Rittenhouse. In this particular regard, the judge was absolutely right to lose it on Binger. Binger questioned Rittenhouse about his decision to invoke his right to remain silent as though it was in some way an acknowledgement of guilt. That is something every single prosecutor knows is off limits. You simply cannot ask a defendant testifying about their invocation of their right to remain silent, and Binger clearly knew that. That would have rightly drawn some anger from Judge Schroeder. But then immediately after that, Binger started going into Rittenhouse's familiarity with firearms, which was a topic that a pretrial hearing had determined he could not ask Rittenhouse about. When it's clear that a judge is already a little antagonistic towards your case, or at least isn't overly friendly, these types of unforced errors are catastrophic. The judge was clearly well within his rights to go after Binger for his inappropriate questions. I would have hoped for and demanded the same thing had I been defending Rittenhouse. Now, on the topic of the judge being biased, I received a very interesting question from listener Kathy Fernandez, who wanted to know whether there is any oversight for a judge's decision mid-trial. Now, I thought it was an excellent question and very relevant to this episode, so here's the answer. We know that if a judge rules against the defendant and then the defendant is convicted, he or she can appeal and say that the judge's rulings prevented the defendant from getting a fair trial, and thus the case should be overturned. But what happens when it's the prosecutor who gets the bad ruling? A defendant is promised a fair trial, but what we often overlook is that the prosecutor is also. And a prosecutor doesn't have the ability to appeal a not guilty verdict. So, does a prosecutor have any recourse if a judge issues a really unfair ruling during a trial? And the answer is yes. A prosecutor can file what's called an interlocutory appeal. This is an appeal that goes on while other aspects of the case or trial are still ongoing. Basically, a prosecutor can appeal the judge's decision to the appellate division if it's truly egregious, and the appellate division can reverse it mid-trial. Now, this is not done all that frequently because, as you can imagine, if you go above a judge's head in the middle of a trial and get a decision that they made overturned, it's not going to engender you with a lot of goodwill. But the fact remains that it is an option for prosecutors who feel that they are being denied a fair trial, and it is done from time to time. But it was not done here. Okay, back to Rittenhouse. If you ignore the thousands of celebrity tweets, the opinions of those people who make their living in entertainment instead of the law, and the conclusions of people who believe that because they think the law should be one way, that it is that way, the Rittenhouse verdict was not altogether surprising. At the end of the day, the defense did a better job of making a compelling case that Rittenhouse was in reasonable fear for his life and acted in self-defense. Now, I want to make it clear that just because I think the defense did a better job of making their case doesn't mean that the prosecution never had a chance here. This was absolutely a winnable case for Banger and his team. Had they prepped their witnesses better, slimmed down who they put on, they could have presented a more streamlined narrative which would have focused on the fact that despite all this chaos and mayhem, only one person in Kenosha shot other people. And not just one person, three people. Banger should have focused more on the fact that time and again, Rittenhouse found himself in situations where he felt he had to shoot someone. He was carrying an assault rifle strapped to his chest. He was 17 years old. He should not have been there. These weren't looters breaking into his house where he shot people inside his own property. He was in a car lot and then in the middle of the street. The case could clearly have been made that he should not have been given the benefit of a self-defense argument because he himself was responsible for provoking the entire situation and did not have the right to use deadly force in response. But juries are not asked to decide cases based on the arguments that could have been made. They decide cases based on the arguments that were made. And in this case, Richards and Chiarifisi knew the facts better, got the testimony they wanted out of each witness, and built up their self-defense narrative brick by brick until it was a wall the prosecution simply could not penetrate. Let's compare the situation with the McMichael trial in Glynn County, Georgia. We know that Travis McMichael shot Ahmaud Arbery while he was running through the Satilla Shores neighborhood. We know Travis was accompanied by his father Gregory, and that Roddy Bryan was in a car behind them, filming the encounter on his cell phone. And we know that Travis McMichael claimed self-defense as well. He stated that Arbery had punched him in the head several times and gone for the shotgun, and that's when he had to shoot the 25-year-old. That's the story which was told to the police, and that's what became the defense narrative. Now, before we dive into this trial, it's worth noting the odd history of how this case actually began, or almost didn't begin. Fans of the show will know that I am one who typically gives people the benefit of the doubt. I'm reluctant to ascribe bad intentions to people without some pretty significant evidence of it. But this situation gives even me pause. As we noted, the shooting took place in Glynn County, in the city of Brunswick, in February 2020. The district attorney for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit was Jackie Johnson at the time. Despite the headlines that the case immediately generated, neither the McMichaels nor Roddy Bryan was initially arrested. In fact, it seemed that absolutely no investigation whatsoever was taking place. Now, Jackie Johnson lost re-election in November 2020 and was subsequently indicted for dereliction of her oath of office for showing favor and affection to Gregory McMichael, who had previously worked in her office. And not long after the February 23rd shooting, Johnson recused herself and appointed George Barnhill to replace her. Barnhill had released a statement to the police the day after the shooting that the three men should not face charges, and his own son had worked alongside Gregory McMichael in Johnson's office. These biases were actually uncovered by Arbery's mother, who has worked tirelessly to move this case along despite incredible odds. Barnhill stayed on until about April 2020, when Arbery's mother went public about his conflict. Then in May of 2020, the video taken by Roddy Bryan was leaked by an attorney. And that's what really set things in motion. The following month, all three men were indicted. But it truly does look like several high-level prosecutors were doing their absolute best to cover for these men, which is a horrific abuse of the justice system. And more than anything else, contributes to why certain communities feel a lack of trust in this institution. It is unconscionable that any prosecutor would use his or her office to shield someone from a homicide investigation. As I noted, Johnson was actually indicted for her role, and Barnhill is currently under investigation for his. Now, with that in mind, we get to the indictment and the trial. The prosecutor on the case was Linda Dunikoski. Travis McMichael was represented by Jason Sheffield. The other two defendants had their own defense teams as well, but for the sake of simplicity, we're going to focus on Travis because, again, he is the shooter. Dunikoski really made the focus of the trial on Travis McMichael, and I think that was a pretty smart decision. Rather than get bogged down with, you know, Travis did this, Gregory did that, Roddy was here, she had a very clean and simple case. She told the jury that the three men had seen Arbery running through the neighborhood. Arbery had not done anything wrong, but that he was chased and cornered anyway. She told the jury that despite the fact that the defendants claimed they believed Arbery was burglarizing a construction site, they came upon him with nothing in his hands, no bag or anything else he could have been carrying something with. Now, despite this, they stopped him, and Travis McMichael engaged him with a shotgun. Over the course of the video, McMichael fires the shotgun three times. Dunikoski told the jury that there were so many ways that this encounter could have gone, which did not need to result in death. But the defendants cut those options off by bringing guns, provoking a deadly situation, and then killing Ahmaud Arbery. Now, Jason Sheffield put McMichael on the stand to testify on his own behalf about what happened. And you'll note that both Rittenhouse and McMichael testified. It's fairly common in self-defense cases for the defendant to testify, because often they are the only witnesses who can explain to the jury why they reasonably felt in fear for their life. So we see self-defense defendants take the stand a decent amount. The defense strategy here was to play up an increase in crime in the Satilla Shores neighborhood, and then claim that that impacted the defendant's mindsets, alerting them to a heightened sense of danger if they encountered a criminal. And to that end, in addition to Travis McMichael, the defense attorneys called many residents of Satilla Shores to testify about their experiences with crime. Here's the issue with that. Not a single person testified to a single instance of violent crime. It was all property crime, car windows being broken, trash cans being knocked over, lights and cameras being hit with rocks. There wasn't a single instance of violent behavior which was brought out. And I think that really hurt the defense case. And then there was Travis's testimony. The testimony itself was not all too long, and McMichael did a decent job on direct. He gave his story about being struck by Arbery several times and the struggle over the shotgun, testified that he fully believed that if Arbery had been able to get the gun, that he would have been killed, and that he was losing his balance and he had nothing to do but shoot him. He came across as decently measured, sad that it happened, but he maintained that his actions were justified. It was a decent self-defense testimonial. And the cross-examination was not terribly long either, but it was fairly effective. It wasn't full of gotcha moments, but as a defense lawyer, I could see what Dunikoski was doing. She locked McMichael into stories which were not supported by either the video or other evidence in the case. She asked her questions with an eye towards what she could argue in summation. She brought up several inconsistencies with McMichael's trial testimony, as opposed to the statement that he gave to detectives right after the shooting took place. And McMichael really did not have good answers for that, which was problematic, because his whole testimony was that he just wanted to detain Arbery until police arrived, and that he believed his father had already called 911 before they started chasing Arbery. But in his post-shooting statement, he indicated that he didn't think 911 had been called at all, and that he didn't call it. The defendants claimed that they were going to effect a citizen's arrest on Arbery. That's what they all indicated that the plan was. They just wanted to stop him and detain him so the police could come and pick him up, as they determined that Arbery had burglarized the construction site in their neighborhood before. The defense put all their eggs in this basket. That's how they justified chasing Arbery and stopping him, how they justified the physical confrontation. McMichael himself testified that he felt that he had probable cause to believe that Arbery had been committing a crime. In Linda Dunikoski's summation, she told the jury she was going to give them a quick snapshot of the case and then explain things in detail. In the first 5 minutes, she absolutely demolished the citizen's arrest defense. In Georgia, to effect a citizen's arrest, the individual has to have personally witnessed the other person commit the crime. Roddy Bryan was fixing his porch. Travis McMichael was on his couch. Gregory McMichael was just outside, saw Arbery run by. None of the men saw anything remotely indicating that Ahmaud Arbery had committed a crime, and thus they were completely unjustified in making a citizen's arrest. Dunikoski then explained that what the defendants actually did is make an assumption about Arbery based on nothing but prejudice, and then decided they were going to make him stop and talk to them. And then when he wouldn't do that, they killed him. It was an excellent way to begin her summation. It was gripping, and it was effective. From there, she went on to explain how self-defense did not apply here, as there's no question who the initial aggressors were. Beyond that, you cannot claim self-defense if you're in the process of committing a felony against somebody in the state of Georgia. Each of the defense attorneys had the opportunity to give summations for their clients. And when Jason Sheffield spoke for Travis McMichael, he played up McMichael's history with the Coast Guard, his sense of duty, and his training, and making split-second decisions. And I think it would have been a better summation had Dunikoski not spent so much time picking apart how bad the decision-making of the three defendants had been. Sheffield was also forced to try to salvage a citizen's arrest argument, though at that point it had clearly already been lost. Sheffield did his best to minimize the inconsistencies and the issues and to focus on McMichael's testimony about his state of mind, his knowledge of the rise in crime, and his goal of only talking to Arbery, focusing on his testimony that he really did not ever intend to shoot him. In the end, the whole country knows how both of these cases ended up. Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of his charges, while the three Georgia defendants were convicted. In summation, if you're able to keep an open mind and to judge these cases based simply on the evidence that's presented, there's a clear contrast to be made here. Several videos show Kyle Rittenhouse attempting to run away from confrontation, while McMichael was driving straight into it. In one case, the prosecutor did a very good job of showing how the defendants instigated the situation which led to the death, while in the other, the defense attorneys were able to successfully show that the defendant had nowhere to go and no other options available. There were, of course, racial overtones to both trials. Dunikoski explicitly said that McMichael had prejudiced Arbery just because he was black. In the Rittenhouse case, the fact that the backdrop was BLM protest was an important aspect of the case. But the three men who were shot were all white and Jewish. Because of that, race was less of an actual concrete feature of the Rittenhouse trial. It was more in the abstract, was also heavily featured in how people talked about it. Now, this is an important point, and one that I think was getting overlooked a bit. I don't know if Kyle Rittenhouse is a white supremacist, and neither does President Biden. But in terms of his trial, it doesn't matter. As much as we may not like it, our criminal justice system is based on the same protections that we enjoy being offered to white supremacists, hate mongers, bigots, and all manner of undesirable people. Our system does not preclude somebody from defending themselves simply because their personal philosophy we find morally repugnant. As I said before, I think Thomas Binger could have done a much better job with the Rittenhouse prosecution, but I'm really disheartened by the number of celebrities and athletes who I've seen opine that since Kyle Rittenhouse is a white supremacist, he could not have been defending himself. Those two concepts are not mutually exclusive. I don't know what's in Kyle Rittenhouse's heart. Same way I don't know what's in Travis McMichael's heart. I don't know if either of them are racists, or maybe both. Certainly some things have come to light in the media regarding both men, which do not cast them in a saintly glow. But for our purposes here, again, it really doesn't matter. We don't convict people based on their ideologies in this country. In fact, we provide people freedom of conscience and freedom of speech. We allow people to think what they want and don't police them for it. What we do police and prosecute is their actions. Now, sometimes those two are linked, but often a person's personal feelings on race, ethnicities, etc., have nothing to do whether they've committed murder or not. In my opinion, having watched a good deal of both of these trials, I think if you were to separate out all of the toxicity present in the cultural sphere and focus simply on the evidence presented in each case, there's a good case to be made that both juries made the right decision. Self-defense is frequently a difficult thing to argue. Juries can be reluctant to let someone off the hook if they feel that there was another option available to them. Maybe they could have retreated farther, or maybe their actions played too much of a role in creating the confrontation. These two trials taking place at basically the same time, using the same defense with opposite results, really gives us a fascinating ability to look at why one was effective and one wasn't. But I think that you can only actually learn something important here and get the right takeaways if you're willing to leave your biases at the door and look at these cases based only on what was produced during the trials. We've all got our predispositions and innate feelings, but if we can get past them and view these cases objectively, we can understand them for what they are. So that's the show this week on Kyle Rittenhouse and the McMichael Bryan trials. I recognize that these trials were charged. A lot of people had, and continue to have, strong feelings about the verdicts. And it's not my intention to take that away from anyone. Everyone is entitled to agree or disagree with the verdicts as they see fit. My goal here is not to convince you that the juries were right or wrong. It's to try and explain why they decided the way that they did. And then you can decide on your own if you think they got it right or wrong. I've given you my opinion, but you are certainly free to disagree. I'd like to send a special thank you to my brother, Dan Townsend, who does the audio engineering for my show. And I'd also like to send a special thank you to Kathy Fernandez and all the other listeners who send me questions or feedback. I do read and respond to everything, and I appreciate it immensely. If you enjoyed this episode, and you like being able to talk about these cases without injecting politics or culture into the trials, then I encourage you to check out the rest of the library. I do try and bring a neutral view to these cases, and from the feedback that I get, it seems that people appreciate that. On that note, if you want to reach out to me, you can do so by emailing me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at InsummationPod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Let me know if you prefer that we do these more recent cases. If so, I will try and cover more contemporaneous trials when I can. So that's all from me for this episode. Thank you so much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.